Mark McCandlish grew up with an interest in aircraft and other modes of transportation. He joined the Air Force, later made use of the GI Bill to attend Art Center College of Design, and he later worked for a short time in the Hollywood special effects business as a matte artist, and then was hired by the General Dynamics Corporation in Pomona, California, as a technical illustrator and technical publications editor. During this time, Mark was also given the opportunity to participate in a number of media orientation rides in frontline U.S. Air Force and Air National Guard fighters, such as the F-15 Eagle, the F-16 Fighting Falcon. In 1986, Mark became aware that the U.S. military was in possession of some extraordinary technologies and began to pursue his own private research into where it came from and how it works. The research led to many strange events and encounters, and he is our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Back since your last show was with Art, if I'm correct, Mark, was that about 7.5 years ago?
Yes, sir, George. What a great pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise. Oh, that was a long time. What's gone on in your life since then?
Well, it's been an interesting ride. It's had its ups and downs, but I think that at long last I finally figured out how some of these things actually work, and I've been corresponding with a number of people for probably the better part of the last 15 years to try and get to the bottom of what makes the technologies, these various technologies, work. And it's been pretty exciting. I think it holds great promise for the future.
I think so, too. And we're going to talk about all those. And I assume, Mark, that some of them, the knowledge of, did it come from strange places?
Yes, absolutely strange places. I mean, some of the things that I'm going to share with you this evening are fairly incredible. And yet, some of the evidence was matched on the other side of the equation by actual eyewitness accounts from people in the aerospace industry or the military or both, as well as some of the more unusual sources as well.
I noticed that you did work at General Dynamics, and when I was in St. Louis for a long time, their headquarters were there. What a powerful company that was in terms of the technology and the innovation that they came up with.
Yeah, they're a wonderful company. In fact, I think they were eventually acquired by Lockheed Martin.
Yeah,
I know that it always was a little disturbing to me that we took great pride in the F-16 when I worked for General Dynamics, and when it was taken over by Lockheed, you know, we were a little disturbed by hearing the phrase the Lockheed F-16.
Yeah. Yeah, we know better than that, though, don't we? Hey, of everything that you've looked at then, let's say over the past 7.5 years, mm-hmm. is there an area there that has just really blown your mind?
Well, I think that, honestly, some of the advances that have been made in conventional aircraft have been really remarkable. Some of the capabilities that have come together in terms of really strange-looking aircraft that ordinarily wouldn't be able to fly without the aid of a computer to control just the absolute minute movement of the control surfaces and control the airflow around the aircraft. Otherwise, it would crash. I mean, some of the things, the stealth fighter, the F-117A Nighthawk in particular, is probably the most odd-looking aircraft one will see with all of the flat, faceted surfaces that make it so stealthy. And yet, with the assistance of computers, it's still able to stay in the air and fly quite well.
As a matter of fact, I took that name, Nighthawk, when I was a talk show host in St. Louis.
Did you really?
That's what I was called, but it was based on that jet.
Is that right?
Yeah. And I tell you what, and it worked because, you know, people began to identify you with that, and it just
sure.
took off.
Yeah,
it really. I've got to ask you this before we get going. A buddy of mine is at the airport in Chicago.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, he's going to be a guest first hour Thursday, talking about something like the Field of Dreams. He's sitting down next to a guy, some real old 72-year-old crusty guy, and they're just talking about stuff. And this guy said, well, he's going up to Chicago, he's finalizing some papers with attorneys, but apparently in Illinois, he is developing and has already started this, extracting from coal the ability to make gasoline. He said he's making out. Now, you tell me if you think this is true or not, but this guy swears that it's true. He is taking gasoline, coal, turning it into gasoline, making it at for $20 a barrel, selling it to the military. They're using it. They're buying as much as he can produce. He's in the process of getting the state of Illinois to, I guess, finance a major manufacturing plant for this, a refinery, I guess.
Sure.
And he's going to do it. And apparently he is the grandson of a guy named Harry Bracey, who was a zillionaire at the time. He's dead now, from Marion, Illinois.
Well, it always helps if you have plenty of funding.
Yes, absolutely. But, I mean, is this a way to really get gasoline? And if so, why in the heck aren't we doing it?
Well, you know, I'd heard of a process called the gasification of coal a number of years ago, but I always thought that it meant that they were getting some other kind of flammable hydrocarbon mixture or solution of some kind out of the coal itself. I've never actually heard of anyone producing gasoline itself directly from coal.
Well, believe it or not, in World War II, the Germans got gasoline and diesel from coal because they were cut off from Middle Eastern oil. Mm-hmm. So they had to get their own synthetic fuels, and apparently they got it that way.
Well, you know, I mean, gasoline and coal and a lot of other flammable liquids are all sort of volatile organic compounds, hydrocarbons. And it just seems to me that if you have your chemistry right, you ought to be able to modify these things and make some other kind of combustible liquid, if you will. Now, I remember Dr. Morgus had asked you about joining him in an endeavor to create a new, I think he said it was a golf ball-sized pill.
Yes.
That you could put into a gas tank full of water and convert it all to gasoline. Now, I know that that sounds just absolutely incredible, but as it turns out, there is a chemical that, because of its unstable nature, when it is introduced into water, and this chemical is called hydrazine, I have been told, and I remember this all the way back from high school chemistry, that if you introduce a molecule of hydrazine into a body of distilled water, that it'll convert the entire body of water to hydrazine.
Which is flammable.
Yes, highly flammable. In fact, I think they even use it in the space program, or at least in some of the rockets.
That might be what Dr. Morgus was working on, and then eventually we had the horrid Hurricane Katrina. We lost touch with him for a while, and then he popped back up again, thank God.
Well, you know, I think it's possible. I don't know that you would actually wind up with something that you could use in a typical fuel-injected engine. I don't know if it would be something that would work well. Hydrazine, that is, because it's extremely volatile, and with higher compression engines like some of the cars that we have, not every car is high compression. Most of them are around 9, 9.5 to 1 compression ratio. But if you have an extremely volatile combustible liquid that you introduce into a situation like that, you get an extreme case of knocking or pre-ignition because it wants to light off when it starts to get compressed and heated.
Maybe there's a way you can control that.
Well, that's kind of the thinking behind high-test gasoline. They add octane, other chemicals to the gasoline that actually slow down the combustion process, so it isn't as much of an explosion as it is a very, very fast burn. That's why, low-test, it's 87-octane gasoline, is the most volatile of the three gasolines that are offered, and that's why they suggest that you use high-octane gasoline, because if you have a high-performance, high-compression engine, you know, say 10.5 or 11 to 1, you're going to get problems with pre-ignition and knocking. So that's one of the reasons why they recommend high-test for engines that are high-performance or high-compression.
But I got to tell you, if this guy is making $20 gasoline per barrel, and we're paying 60 to 70 now.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we should be converting. We've got more coal than we need in this country.
That's true, and it makes perfect sense that the military would be the first customer in line, especially when you consider the strategic reserves that are probably being released by the White House.
But they don't want us to know about this, Mark.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. As long as I'm going to make the petroleum industry angry, I might as well go all the way. And a friend of mine, in fact, a fellow that I know very well, shared something with me about 6 months ago, something that you can add to the gasoline in your tank, and I will put out a disclaimer immediately before I say anything, and that is that this works best with premium gas, unfortunately.
Which is 91?
Yeah, well, 91, 92, depending on what state you're in.
Right, okay.
And it will not work with gasoline that has ethanol added to it, or the so-called gasohol. But if you go down to your local paint store or to most automotive parts stores and get yourself a quart of acetone for about $8.
A quart of acetone?
Yes, A-C-E-T-O-N-E.
Okay.
And you put a ratio, a very, very small amount, comparatively speaking, but you put in 2.5 ounces of acetone for every 10 gallons of gasoline that you buy.
All right, so if you have a 20-gallon tank, what's a standard tank?
If you have a 20-gallon tank and you fill it up, assuming that it's empty and you fill it up, you would put in 5 ounces of acetone.
All right, that's not much.
No. It works out to something like about 45 or 50 cents for every 10 gallons, I guess. But the story that I heard was that it actually chemically alters the gasoline in your tank, and it permits more complete combustion of the gasoline, and it improves the combustion efficiency. Now, I was very skeptical when I heard about this. In fact, the very first question that I asked of my friend was, how is this going to harm my engine? Is it going to, you know,
trouble? Yeah, is it going to blow it up or something?
With,
sure.
You know, my fuel injectors and this kind of thing. And he said, no, absolutely not. If anything, it winds up cleaning the engine. You wind up with, a smoother running engine. So I gave it a shot. And in fact, not only did I get between 25 and 35% better gas mileage, the downside is that you actually feel more power when you step on the gas, and it becomes such a temptation to just floor it every chance you get for all that extra power that you might be able to
get
out of your engine.
It seems simple enough. Now, is this allowable? Can we do this?
Well, that's the funny thing. I've been using this in two different cars now, and one of them just had required the registration to be renewed, so I had to go down and get a smog test, and I thought, well, here's a perfect opportunity.
Uh-huh.
So I put in a full tank of gas, measured in the proper amount of acetone, and it passed with flying colors. And this is a car that hasn't had a tune-up in 2 years.
Okay, now two questions then. Most gasoline that you get now at the pumps has some amount of ethanol in it, right?
Well, now it varies from area to area. I mean, in some places, I know that in some parts of Southern California, it's used quite a bit.
Yeah, even 10%.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm up here in Northern California, and I'm not aware that they're actually using that much. I know that there was quite a bit of controversy over what MTBE, methyl tribulene.
Oh, that stuff's a cancer causer, yeah.
Yeah. But as far as I know, it will not work well with gasoline, ethanol.
Okay, so even if there's 10% ethanol in this premium fuel, this will not work that well?
Not as well as it would with just straight gasoline.
Okay.
And the recommendation is to use premium.
But, I mean, my biggest fear then on this would be I'm going to blow up my engine or something.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is that I have a Nissan Maxima that I've maintained, and I've driven this car with Mobil 1 synthetic oil in it, you know, changing it every 3,000 miles with a new filter. And I've got almost 210,000 miles on this car. I've never had the engine apart once. And about a month ago, I cracked an exhaust manifold stud, had an exhaust leak, so I decided to pull the exhaust manifold off and get rid of the stud, replace it. And I was just absolutely shocked when I pulled the exhaust manifold off. That is the piece where the exhaust gases first come out of the engine and start to enter the exhaust system that goes back to the muffler on the car. And this exhaust manifold, normally you would expect to see, you know, sort of a charcoal maybe a medium gray discoloration from the carbon and so forth that's left over from the combustion process. And I looked down inside this exhaust manifold, and it was pure white inside. It was as though someone had gone in there and just sandblasted all of the carbon and everything off the inside of that exhaust manifold. I was amazed, but even more so, over the period of a couple hundred thousand miles, as this engine has on it, you get a certain amount of oil leakage around the valve stem, and it comes down and it starts to coke or heat up and be cooked onto the back face of the valve, and it creates these deposits which over time will begin to retard the passage of the exhaust gases and will, undermine the performance of the engine. Well, you know, naturally with 210,000 miles or so on the car, I would expect to see some serious deposit there. And when I looked up inside the exhaust ports, the valve stems were perfectly clean, shiny. I mean, this was just amazing to me.
Well, now, what is the acetone used for when you go into, like, an auto parts?
Ordinarily, acetone would be used to thin down polyester resins in a fiberglass. If you're making fiberglass resin, you're mixing it up, and you want to have it be a little bit thinner, say if you're going to be using it to patch some damage on a fiberglass boat or, say, on a Corvette fender or something like that.
All right.
Where fiberglass is
so it's easily attainable in these stores?
Yes. Okay. Yes, about $8 a quart. At least it is in California.
And 2.5 ounces to every 10 gallons.
Now, and the other thing is that it's even less for the diesel mixture. It would be 1.5 ounces for every 10 gallons
for
of
diesel fuel.
Yes.
So truck drivers could be saving a fortune now.
Uh-huh. I have one report of a fellow up in Seattle who I wasn't sure exactly what the circumstances were. It sounded like perhaps he worked with the sheriff's department and was towing a boat into town behind his truck every day from up in the Cascade Mountains where he lived, going into Seattle. And he was saying that for 44 or 45 cents worth of acetone, he was saving $12 in diesel.
Gosh, that's a great savings.
It's remarkable.
That adds up.
Yeah.
And the increase in the mileage?
25 to 35%.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, I know this sounds far-fetched, and I know there's some people out there that are thinking, well, you know, I've got a carburetor on my car, and I'm worried about this stuff melting the float. Now, I don't know of too many cars. In fact, I can't even think of one that has a pure styrofoam float in it. Most of the older carburetors from the 40s and 50s, I believe they used brass floats. And most of the floats that have been made since the late 60s, early 70s used a type of phenolic plastic, which I think is pretty much impervious to acetone, even in its purest form. What I would do if I was concerned about that, if I had an older car with a carburetor, I would maybe run down to the junkyard and pull a float out of a similar vehicle and then dip it in some pure acetone and see what happens before you try it in the car.
See if it gets eaten alive or something.
Yeah, really.
All right. Hey, we're going to take a break very shortly, Mark, and when we come back, let's talk about some of this strange technology that
sounds
is out there and where some of it may have come. Do you have a website, by the way, you want to give us?
Yes. It's markmccandlish.com.
Okay.
MarkMccandlish.
Okay. We'll make sure Lex has that linked up with your name. Can people email you if they want through your website? Can they get to you that way?
I think there is a flag or a tab in there for contact. Honestly, Lisa Lyons contacted me on Thursday, so I mean, as of yesterday, I did not have a website. This is all new to me.
And, oh, okay.
I honestly just
welcome. Welcome to the world.
Yes.
All right, stay with us, Mark. We'll be back with you in a moment. We'll talk about this technology, strange technology, unusual, where it came from. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast. Stay out. With our guest, Mark McKendlish, I'm George Norrie, and the ratio, again, those of you writing in on this acetone to gallons of premium gasoline, 2.5 ounces to every 10 gallons. You did throw out a disclaimer there, though, Mark. Is it because you haven't done the research into it?
Well, you know, I haven't actually done laboratory testing. I was informed by the gentleman that shared this with me that the actual research had been done by some chemical engineers in the Seattle area. And that there had been extensive testing before any such claims were made. I simply think that, you know, people, if they're looking for, you know, a catch-all solution to the high price of gasoline, this may not necessarily be it, but it at least from my perspective, it certainly
helps.
Couldn't hurt. Yeah.
Right. Any research into what it might do to the rubber fuel lines or lines that are in your car? Some people think it could eat right through it. I don't know if that's possible or not.
Well, it depends on the kind of rubber, I suppose. I know that MTBE was noted for having that kind of a side effect.
Yes.
And now it's sort of being eliminated from the gas supply little by little. But I've been using this in the gasoline, and you have to remember that 2.5 ounces for every 10 gallons is a very, very small ratio.
Well, that's true. It's not a lot.
You know, I mean, honestly, it's about equal to what you would find in a shot glass. And then compare that to, say, a 10-gallon, gas can that you might, carry on your Jeep or something.
So if you use a measuring cup, make sure you don't use the same cup for your cooking.
Absolutely, yes. And another thing, too, is you have to be very careful about handling this stuff. You don't want to get it on your skin. You sure don't want to get it in your eyes. And I wouldn't recommend letting it sit on your paint of your car either, because you know, there's a good chance that it might damage your paint.
This is used in finger polish remover, isn't it? I think it is.
Well, you know what? I'm not.
If I remember it from my married days, I think it is.
Well, I haven't done too many manicures lately, so I'm not really sure.
No, I'm not into that either. Some guys do this though. They get manicures and pedicures. That's another high technology for a different show, Mark, when we have you back.
Sure.
All right. Let's talk about some of this aircraft. First of all, several years ago, I'm on the air in St. Louis. All of a sudden, I start getting calls from people in the Illinois area, which right across the river from St. Louis, divided by the Mississippi. And they say, George, we're seeing this massive size object, huge object. And I had them starting to describe it for us, and it was triangular in shape, huge, football field size, maybe bigger. Mm-hmm. And the big thrust of the story was when several Millstatt, Illinois police officers saw the same thing. Now, we are very close to Scott Air Force Base, and where they were out there in Illinois, extremely close.
Well, I seem to remember that case. Yeah, it was on TV, too.
Yeah. Now, what do we know about an object like this?
Well, back in the late 1980s and right around 1990, there was a patent that was issued to a gentleman with a company called Aireon Corporation in New Jersey.
Aireon.
It's A-E-R-E-O-N, I believe, is the name of the company. And he had developed a patent. In fact, I think I have the patent number right here. I'll have to thumb through some material. You can actually find this on, here we go. Patent number 4896160, issued January 23rd, 1990, for what he was calling the Aireon Dynair ship. Now, the original concept, as described in the patent, called for a triangular-shaped blimp, if you will, or a lighter-than-air vehicle, also known as an LTAV, that would be used as a platform for an airborne radar system. And just to give you an idea now, if you wanted to lift something with hot air, you can lift a big block Chevrolet engine, you know, almost 500 pounds, with a bag of hot air the size of a city bus. So, I mean, that sounds pretty dramatic if you think about it. Just hot air being able to lift 500 pounds, but that in fact is roughly the ratio that you need between, you know, the weight you're lifting and the size of a hot air containment vessel that you would need. So imagine something that's 450 feet long, and that was what the original prototype design for the Aireon Dynair ship called for. Now, there were many follow-up programs. In fact, the Lockheed Corporation and a number of other companies, there was a whole string of developmental proposals for airships of this kind. In fact, there was a feasibility study that was part of the, from the proceedings of the, the Royal Aeronautical Society. I even have the publication here. 01499-3515 was called the Future of the Airship, a Technical Appraisal. And this was a symposium on what might be possible with lighter-than-air vehicles, given that we now have composite materials, carbon composites, fiberglass, and other things that were not available back in the 30s and the 40s when airships like the Hindenburg and the Macon were, you know, sort of in the vogue. And at the highest level of technology for that time, the materials that they have to make these kinds of things now are so much lighter and so much stronger, you know, by a factor of maybe 100 or more.
Maybe they're made with carbon fibers?
Exactly, because, you know, these things, if properly constructed, are extremely rigid, in some cases lighter and stronger than steel would be. And the neat thing about it is that they're almost completely invisible to radar. Which, of course, I think was one of the things that was mentioned when people made inquiries to the flight control tower at Scott Air Force Base, is that they said they didn't have anything on radar. So the idea was that you come up with something that it may not be the fastest mode of transportation possible, but it allows you to move a tremendous amount of manpower and equipment very quickly. I mean, relatively speaking, if you can be on the other side of the planet in 24 hours with an entire armored division in a vehicle that might be, you know, 1,000 feet long and 750 feet wide at the trailing end of this, you know, triangular, you know, sort of like an arrowhead flying through the air, if you will. That gives you a tremendous logistical advantage in any kind of warfare.
How fast does it move?
Well, now, if you remember the Phoenix Lights scenario,
right,
the 13th of March, 1997, there were sightings of this vehicle, one or more vehicles, between Henderson, Nevada, going all the way down through, I believe, Payson and Prescott, Arizona.
The so-called flares.
Well, now, I will admit that there is a military operations range or airspace. They call them MOAs, or military operation airspace. I believe that is southwest of Phoenix, where there were some aircraft from, I believe it was Luke Air Force Base, that were conducting night operations. And there's some fairly conclusive proof that a lot of what was being filmed was, in fact, some flares that were appearing one by one as they were being dropped by possibly an F-16 or more, or other kinds of aircraft. And they would wink out one by one as they dropped down behind the mountain range that was in that direction from Phoenix. But now this is the interesting thing. My family, my dad was stationed at Williams Air Force Base, which until it was decommissioned, was located east of Chandler, Arizona, which is just south of Phoenix. And so I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in Chandler. I grew up right across the street from the local high school in Chandler. And we have a number of family friends that even to this day have lived in that neighborhood. And as it happened, this vehicle flew right over that neighborhood where many of my family friends still reside. And it was seen. And it was, in fact, a kind of not so much a triangle as sort of a wide sweeping a boomerang shape from what they were saying.
But huge.
Yes, absolutely immense. Now, you know, not to say that it isn't possible for some really exotic technology, something, you know, a little more sophisticated than a lighter-than-air vehicle to be, you know, the object of the inquiry. But it is possible based on the things that I've seen, the things that have been shared with me, that, you know, you could construct a really immense vehicle of this kind using the kind of composite materials that are now being used in the space program and in other parts of the aerospace industry.
Because, it moves so slowly sometimes, Mark, people could take a shot at this thing.
Well, now, you know, one of the there's a fellow up in Seattle, Mr. Davenport.
Peter
Davenport. Now, he and I have talked on many occasions. We don't always see eye to eye, but, you know, I have a tremendous respect for the guy. He has dedicated his life to this
sort
of thing.
Absolutely.
And I kind of, you know, I had a number of maps of Arizona because I go there from time to time, even now. And so I had all these locations from Henderson down through Prescott and Payson and these various areas down through Phoenix and then to Tucson. And I charted the moment-to-moment sightings that at least were reliable. And as far as I could tell, this thing never traveled faster than 450 miles an hour.
Well, even then, that's pretty fast
for something that could
be balloon-like.
But you know, one of the things that has become apparent to me from some of the testimony that I've been privy to is that these are extremely advanced designs for what they are. You know, even as lighter-than-air vehicles, they have a tremendous amount of buoyancy. I mean, if you can take an entire armored division and move it from one place to another in a blimp of all things, I mean, you know, and maybe that's not the most appropriate term for it, but if you can do that and you can use jet engines that are buried inside of the fuselage with a fairly substantial amount of ducting that comes from the inlets and goes back to, say, a nozzle, you know, say maybe as many as six nozzles. Imagine having anywhere from six to as many as 12 engines, the size of the engines that you'd find on a 747.
Okay. Yeah.
And they're down inside.
But they're pretty silent, these things.
Well, now, you see, you have to remember that there's an awful lot of technology that's been adapted to the practice of achieving stealth in the aerospace industry. They have electronic and acoustic cancellation of noise. I mean, part of what makes a jet engine make so much noise is the fact that when those high-velocity, superheated, and compressed gases come out of the exhaust pipe of a jet engine, what you're really hearing there is the shear forces that occur between the jet exhaust and the surrounding ambient calm air. Now, if you're standing directly behind a jet, you know, say several hundred yards behind it, you will find that the noise at that location isn't nearly as loud as it is when you're standing directly beside the point where the exhaust gases come out. And I only know this because when I was in the Air Force and when I worked on F-106s, we occasionally would have to do an engine test. We'd run it up on the ground with the aircraft basically tied to the ground, big, you know, concrete pad with cables. And they would put the thing into full afterburner while we were standing right there with ear protection and everything. And the rumble coming off that exhaust blast was just absolutely dramatic.
Well, what are the possibilities, Mark, that this object is either extraterrestrial or man-made but reverse-engineered from some kind of extraterrestrial craft?
Well, you know, I can't completely discount that. You know, I don't really have the answer for that, George. I can speculate. But I would say this. If you've ever seen that film with George C. Scott about the Hindenburg disaster, one of the things that you may remember from that film is when they first get underway, one of the problems that they have with a large airship like that moving through the air, displacing the air, is that it builds up a tremendous static electric charge. In fact, there's been many people who have said they thought that this may have been the underlying cause of why the hydrogen ignited when this thing came in and was not properly grounded before it began to land.
Actually, too, I was told that a lot of the paint on the Hindenburg and the stuff like that caught fire first, mm-hmm. that the hydrogen fire was a secondary.
Well, that's entirely possible. But the point I was coming to was that if you have a tremendous amount of static electricity that you can tap right from the fact that you are pushing a huge vessel through the air, all of that static electricity can be stored in capacitors. And if the capacitors are properly structured, if they are properly designed, they themselves can actually be used as a propulsive force-creating device. And we know this from the work that was done by Agnew Bahnsen, Thomas Townsend Brown, and I think the third gentleman's name was Alfred Biefield, also known as the Biefield-Brown effect. Typically, you find this in what are called asymmetrical plate capacitors, where you have a number of parallel plates of a conductor with an intervening layer of some kind of insulating material, typical something like plastic or mica or glass, quartz in some cases. And given the different sizes of these plates, you can create this actually a kind of levitating force by putting a high voltage electrostatic charge on the capacitor, and the plates are stacked up so they alternate in polarity. That is, that the you have the positive negatives. You go from the bottom to the top of the stack, and so imagine that you have conventional gasoline powered prop engines pushing this huge vessel through the sky. It's building up a tremendous electrostatic charge, and then somebody says, well, why don't we see if we can't use that electrical charge and maybe do something with it? And then in the 1930s, when Alfred Biefield and Thomas Townsend Brown first began investigating this effect, it's well within the realm of possibility that someone thought, where can we go to get a lot of static electricity for minimal cost, and it would be inside a blimp.
Well, okay, though, but again, extraterrestrial or reverse?
Well, in the case of some of the more modern sightings, there are some of these vessels, particularly the ones that are triangular in shape, that do suggest, and in fact, some of the sightings, particularly the ones in Europe, have shown a capability of a tremendous acceleration from a standing stop to nearly disappearing in a flash. And in that case, I would say we're not talking about a lighter-than-air vehicle. We're probably talking about something far more advanced, something more akin to anti-gravity or some kind of perhaps a warp drive, if you will.
Would the fellow who developed the patent on this, would he have found or stumbled across something extraterrestrial, or could it have been given to him?
Well, in the case of the Ariane Dynair ship, I don't think so.
Okay.
But in the case of some of these other vehicles now, there is a there have been a number of people that have described a triangular shaped anti-gravity vehicle that's been operated out of Area 51. It's actually been misnamed the TR-3A, and that was not an anti-gravity propulsion vehicle. It was a triangular-shaped aircraft with conventional engines, stealthy design, somewhat like a flying Dorito, resembled the early A-12 designs from the 1980s. But this aircraft actually went into production and was produced between, I think, 1990 and about 1993 by McDonnell Douglas. And, in fact, one of my sources indicated that there was a whole squadron of these aircraft based at Tonopah right now, and actually wound up cycling in as the stealth fighters were cycling out into their other duty stations.
So when do we see this officially unveiled, if we're using it right now, testing?
Well, it depends on which system you're talking about. If it's, you know, something along the lines of a more conventional, conventionally powered aircraft, you know, like the so-called TR-3A or TR-3B, the so-called flying Dorito in some circles, you're more likely to see something like that declassified soon. Some of the much more advanced systems, things that use or exploit exotic energy technologies, things like zero-point energy and things of that nature, it's a lot less likely that we're going to see those things declassified soon.
Even though we have them?
Yes. The real controversy right now for anybody who really kind of looks at this and studies the meaning of it, let's say, for example, you had, just for the sake of the discussion, a full-blown anti-gravity propulsion system that was in deployment and was working and is being used on a regular basis, being flown out of secret locations in the United States.
All right, hold that thought right there, Mark. Anti-gravity propulsion, we'll talk about that when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Mark McCandlish, our guest. I want to break into my Braveheart accents of my Scottish and Irish accents, Mark, every time I hear that great last name of yours. Is it Scottish or Irish?
Scotch-Irish.
Is it?
It originated with, I think it was the Quinlis clan, and then became McQuinlis, and then McCandless, and then McCandlish. And evolved over the course of about 800 years, I guess.
I want to yell out the name William Wallace every time I hear your name. That was a great movie, too, by the way.
It was. It really was. In fact, in the opening scene where Mel Gibson rides into the clearing and he's calling one of his compatriots, he actually calls out the name McCandlish.
You're right. You're right. Absolutely. I remember that.
I was kind of floored when I heard that.
Yep. You are right. It was the guy you used to always get into the fights with, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah. Okay.
Right.
Hey, anti-gravity propulsion. First of all, explain what that is. It seems obvious, but give us some more details.
Well, I want to try and keep this as easy and as simple to understand as I can. So I'm going to try and skip all of the heavy physics talk and just kind of lay it out in the most basic terms. Everything in the universe that we are aware of is made up of atoms. They're like little tiny solar systems with a nucleus in the middle, just like a sun, and then all of these electrons that spin around the nucleus, just like the planets. And in this particular universe, they all spin in a particular direction. And the rate at which they spin, for lack of a simpler way to put it, the speed at which these subatomic particles, these electrons, spin around the nucleus is determined in large part by the amount of interaction that they have with something called zero-point energy. Now, that's actually a more simplified name for something that is called quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum in the physics community. Now, that name comes from the fact that this is a type of ambient energy. It's everywhere in the environment, and it can be detected as a slight electrical flux or charge, even down to a temperature of 0 degrees Kelvin, where literally all movement that's related to heat is absent. It is the German physicists in the early years of detecting this used to call as a Zitterbewegung, which means jiggle in German.
Okay.
This is something that was detectable. In fact, Nikola Tesla knew about this around the turn of the century, between the 1890s, early 1900s, and he had actually determined that it also existed or could be detected in a kind of electromagnetic wave what he was calling longitudinal waves, which more recently have come to be known as scalar waves. Now, to give your audience an idea of what a scalar wave might look like, because it's actually a kind of a compression wave, it would be the same as if you laid a strand of pennies out on a smooth table. One touching the next and the next and so on. And then you took another penny and you flicked it into the end of that row. And they all remain stationary, but the one that's on the other end of the line pops off the end and continues, and with none of the intervening pennies moving. Now, that is the perfect model of at least one part of a longitudinal wave. It moves back and forth along the longitudinal axis of the path of emission. Now, in some cases, you find, another example would be this little toy that you can get at some of the gift shops. It looks like a little wood frame with some ball bearings suspended by fish line, and you pull one of the ball bearings out and you let it swing back in sort of a pendulum fashion.
Back
it hits
forth,
the other balls,
yeah.
And it keeps going back and forth. Now, that's really an even better sort of mechanical model of what a longitudinal wave is all about. But because of the way these models, or because these energy forms transit through space-time, they allow for a lot of interesting things to happen. For example, there was a gentleman back around 1903, he was a contemporary of Einstein, Edmund T. Whittaker, wrote a couple of papers that were produced or published in a German physics journal. I think it was called Mathematische Annalen, or the Analysis of Mathematics, that are more commonly known as the first and second Whittaker papers, Edmund T. Whittaker. And he talked about the fact that these so-called longitudinal waves could not only be modulated like an AM-FM radio signal, but they could also be broadcast. They could be transmitted and received. Now, getting back to this energy form, and I'm trying to kind of help you visualize this, if you looked at matter as a moving system of little tiny particles on the atomic level, these things are always in motion. They're like the perfect perpetual motion machine. They never stop. They never slow down. They never cease to exist. I think Einstein that said that matter could neither be created nor destroyed?
Nor destroyed.
Well, so matter itself, in a sense, is sort of the perfect free energy device. It is something that always exists. It never goes away. It never slows down. But the question is, why? Why do these little particles never slow down? Why do they keep going? And it is because there is energy that is sort of boiling up into this dimension out of sort of a parallel hyperspace, if you will, and that is what they believe is going on with the appearance of zero-point energy in the environment. And it is almost immediately absorbed by all the subatomic particles in this particular dimension. And so that is essentially what keeps everything in motion, at least on the atomic and subatomic level. So imagine, if you will, that you have all these little particles spinning around very, very quickly. And it's almost like a child's top, or a yo-yo. Once it starts spinning, it has a certain amount of energy. And in fact, if you spin a top, or even a little like a gyroscope, a little model, sort of like a little bicycle wheel held in a cage, if you spin it fast enough, it actually creates kind of a field that resists movement from external sources. In other words, you can take a top, and if you spin it fast enough, it feels kind of hard to move it. It resists movement because it's got this its own self-contained little field that it creates a force. Well, if you imagine every atom in our universe being like that, and then you found a way to prevent that spinning motion from continuing, if you found a way of interrupting that absorption of zero-point energy, you could then get those particles to slow down, and the effect of mass and inertia would drop away. It would begin to decrease. Now, you've probably seen the program Stargate SG-1.
Oh, sure.
We talk about inertial dampeners. Well, now you have to remember that the very reason that Einstein said it is impossible to go faster than the speed of light is because as you accelerate through space-time, your mass increases. Now, mass is a variable. It fluctuates as you accelerate through space-time, as you go through the environment, it increases, and as you slow down, it decreases. So it's a variable thing. Now, if you realize that the whole underlying cause of the effect of mass and inertia is this interaction, this powering up of the subatomic particles by the existence and interaction with zero-point energy, then you begin to realize that if there's some way that you can block that interaction so that it doesn't happen, then the atomic structure begins to lose its mass. Even though it remains intact as a structure, it begins to reduce its mass. It's not the same thing, but it would be kind of like saying it weighs less.
Are we violating any laws of physics then?
Well, not necessarily, because now here's the thing. One of the reasons that Einstein said that you couldn't go faster than the speed of light was because as you accelerate through space-time, your mass increases. Well, why does that happen? It's because as you go through the environment, the rate at which you encounter this energy increases. So it means the little subatomic particles in the nucleus of every atom, they begin to spin faster and faster. In a sense, they become more energized. And when that happens, the effect of mass, like I said before, which is variable, it begins to increase. So if you have a way of blocking that energy, that interaction, you, in essence, can change what is supposed to be happening to something else. In other words, let's say, for example, you are able to exploit and use that energy that would otherwise increase the mass of your vehicle and use that energy as a propulsive force, then work is conserved. You are not losing anything. You're not violating any physical laws. What you're doing is you're exploiting energy in an environment to propel your aircraft forward or your vehicle forward. And at the same time, you're reducing the effect of mass and inertia. So, and you have to remember that as you begin to move through space-time faster and faster, when this interaction would normally increase more and more and more, what it really means is that you have more and more energy available to go even faster still, while at the same time you continue to decrease what the actual mass of your vehicle is.
Is this technology, though, Mark, alien technology? If anything we've talked about tonight is, to me it sounds like it's this.
Well, that's the funny question. That's really the $25,000 question, George, because the very first time that I was told by an eyewitness, and I have multiple eyewitnesses on this particular type of technology, it was actually referred to as an alien reproduction vehicle. Now, that in and of itself suggests that...
Credible people, Mark?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. People that have worked in the aerospace industry, just like I have, for some of the biggest defense contractors out there, just like I have. In fact, one of the earliest witnesses that I have spoken with is good friends with an editor at a trade journal, Aviation Week and Space Technology. And he was actually a crew chief at Edwards Air Force Base in 1973 and was asked to go over to an installation at the north end of the complex called Edwards North Base Facility. It's where they usually keep most of the classified test vehicles buttoned up and away from prying eyes. And he was a crew chief on an aircraft that was being flight tested, a non-classified aircraft, I might add. But he was asked to go over to North Base and pick up what we used to call in the Air Force a mule, which is a ground power unit that supplies hydraulic pressure to the control surfaces of an aircraft when the engine is not running. And he was told that after he took this particular component, towed it with a slow-moving tow vehicle to the maintenance depot, that he could leave for the rest of the evening. He was on, you know, a graveyard shift to begin with, so going home early was something that he was looking forward to. So, but, you know, here he was, about a 22 or 23-year-old kid, and naturally he thought, well, you know, the security over there is so tight.
Sure.
Rather than taking perimeter road around to past the north gate of Edwards and around to the west end of the North Base complex, he just cut straight across the dry lake bed where the shuttle lands and figured that when he came up on the tarmac that they would, you know, the security people would spot him before he even got there, and they would meet him at the edge of the tarmac and say, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
So, but the problem was they were expecting him at the gate, and so that's where they were at, and they didn't meet him when he came up on the tarmac. So he was driving this tow vehicle down this row of sort of Quonset hut-style hangars and saw one down the line that had the doors cracked a foot or two and the lights on. He figured, well, that's where it's got to be. And he rolled up in front of this opening on the tow vehicle, and here is this thing sitting in the hangar, flat on the bottom, sloping sides,
oh,
kind of like a bell shape with a dome on the top, little glass bubbles all over the top with what looked like a camera system in each one, no windows, a little bit of a ledge around the base of this dome, which is actually the top half of a sphere-shaped crew compartment. In fact, if some of your listeners go up to the website, you can actually see a cutaway illustration of what this vehicle looked like.
Now, whose was it?
Well, this was something that apparently had been back engineered from something that had been recovered. Now, if you think about the time span between, say, 1947 and, you know, the so-called Roswell incident,
right,
and 1973, when this particular event, you know, the young man going
to
North Base,
yeah,
you know, that's what
26 years,
25 years or something, and so it's completely within the realm of possibility that over 20 years' time, if you have enough funding and enough time and enough brilliant minds to look at a completely foreign propulsion system, that you might be able to figure out a part of it. Now, the interesting thing is that there was another witness who said that he had seen this thing at Norton Air Force Base as well, which, as you may recall, is the same facility where Philip Corso indicated,
yes,
that they had one of these particular kinds of aircraft that from time to time you could go to, you know, if you were a high-level brass in the military, you could go there and play golf and go over and kick the tires on a flying saucer. Well, it turns out there was a golf course practically right next to the main runway at Norton Air Force Base. It was literally about a mile from where I used to live in the city of Rialto back in the late 80s, early 1990s. And I, you know, on occasion would go to air shows there, you know, when they had them on an annual basis. So, you know, I had a friend who had gone there and had expected to see, you know, the SR-71 Blackbird and some other things, and he wound up being in the company of someone who had the credentials and had the influence to get him into a little show that was going on in the big hangar at the facility. I think it was building number 625, if I remember correctly. I'd have to check that particular fact out. But he had an opportunity to see these things. And there were a number of other aircraft, including the so-called Aurora, the first generation of which was really more or less sort of a rounded diamond-shaped type of
aircraft. And again, maybe reverse engineered, at least in terms of looks and appearance?
Well, the Aurora aircraft was actually much closer to the original shape that Kelly Johnson at Lockheed and Ben Rich stumbled across when they were looking at the ideal shape for a stealthy type of aircraft. They had actually talked about a kind of clipped or faceted, flattened out diamond shape as being pretty much the ideal and perfect stealthy shape. And in fact, that's pretty much what this aircraft looked like. Now, another thing that you might be interested in is there is a painting that I did recently for a friend of mine, Mike Schratt, who commissioned a painting of the so-called F-19. Well, it would appear, based on the shape and the orientation of the propulsion system, that this so-called F-19 was actually sort of the proof of concept aircraft for the Aurora, in that it had the same kind of a body, no wings, you know, really just a flattened out diamond shape with a little bit of a ridge that ran laterally across the sort of lifting body fuselage, if you will, with sort of triangular shaped NACA duct type inlets for the engine, with some ports on the trailing edge that allowed the exhaust gases from the engines to come out. But this particular version had both a dorsal and a ventral vertical stabilizer. That is, it had a tail above and below the fuselage, kind of like a sunfish.
Sure.
In fact, there's an image of that particular painting that I did for Mike on the website that they can go and look to. And in fact, it'll give you also an idea of, imagine that same thing without the tails, and you've essentially got what was the first generation Aurora. Now, in 1997, Jane's Defense Weekly published a rather rudimentary illustration that was supposed to have come from the Phantom Works of McDonnell Douglas near, I think it's Tempe, Arizona, which is also near Phoenix. And it had almost this exact same shape. Now, the interesting thing about that was that the drawing showed two inlets, but three exhaust ports. Now, my thinking here is that this was kind of artistic shorthand for what was really going on with the propulsion system, because one of the witnesses that I had spoken with about this particular aircraft said that it actually had two different kinds of propulsion systems, a set of internal engines that had a set of inlets that would open up trapdoor fashion to let air in for the engines, and then some exhaust ports that were also like trapdoors that would open and close depending on what they were doing. But there was also a slight ridge that ran crossways across the widest part of the body, and they would spray fuel out of these fuel injectors along the trailing edge of that, and it would basically pinch the rear of the vehicle and drive it forward at up to 12,000 miles per hour.
Stay with us, Mark. Much more to talk about with you when we come back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Mark McKendlish. Mark, this incredible sketch here that we have on your website, and there's also a link to it on coasttocoastam.com, of this object, this cutaway that you were talking about. Clearly, you can see the spot where these extraterrestrials or these pilots, whomever might be in this craft, would sit at the top. There's not much room else for anything. How big was this object, and is it possible it's some kind of time machine?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, George. The ejection seats are actually an ACES II ejection seat right out of your typical F-4 Phantom that was built by McDonnell Douglas. They do, however, have a kind of foot tray underneath them that's on a kind of a modified a chassis or frame that goes underneath the seat to support that tray. And that's largely because the circular floor beneath those seats is actually part of a static electricity generator, if you will, like kind of like a Wimshurst generator, I think you might say. And so, you want to keep your feet up off the floor while it's spinning, particularly from the corona discharge, the electrostatic charge that comes off that as it's spinning. There were actually three different versions of this vehicle, all pretty much having the same proportions. The smallest of which was about 24 feet in diameter at the base. The next largest size was approximately 60 feet in diameter, and the largest one was approximately 125 to 130 feet in diameter.
Well, that's pretty big.
Yes. In fact, the only thing that really changed, proportionally speaking, on any of those vehicles was the size of the hatch, which remained the same on all three vehicles, and the so-called synthetic vision system that was responsible for allowing the pilot, wearing a specially fitted helmet with sort of a viewing screen on the inside of the visor, would allow him to actually have binocular three-dimensional vision outside of the craft, pairing up a couple of the cameras with a special system that allowed him to literally have both left and right eye viewing to produce a three-dimensional image.
Not much room to walk around.
No. I mean, you pretty much climb in, sit down, and then go.
You better get to where you're going in like an instant, because you're going to go crazy sitting in this thing.
No restroom on this bird.
No. That's a good point. What are these tanks? What are these tanks for?
Well, now, most of the tanks, there's a group that are mounted directly under this sort of electrostatic generator, and there are also a set that are sort of radially mounted around the inside of the bottom of the vehicle, and these are all oxygen tanks. They use a system allows the craft to go beyond the atmosphere, or at least to the upper reaches of it at a minimum, and that's how the pilot and crew members are able to breathe.
Now, are we talking about humans in this thing or extraterrestrials?
Yes. No, this was my belief, based on everything that I've been told by a number of witnesses, was that this was actually our earliest attempt at making an anti-gravity type propulsion vehicle.
Based on alien technology?
Well, that seems to be the conclusion,
right.
Mostly because of the name that they gave it, whether or not it actually had its
right, that could,
origin.
That could have been just...
It could have been just a joke, you know.
It could have been a joke.
Looks like
you're
a flying saucer, we'll call
right.
it, you know. So.
Was it ever used, do you think? Tested?
Yes. In fact, one of the witnesses described seeing a video that was produced at a site that very much had the appearance of what you might expect to see at Area 51, a dry lake bed, mountains way off in the distance. The vehicle hovering, isolated and hovering in the middle of this dry lake bed, and during the initial movements, the vehicle makes three sort of sidelong hopping motion, sort of, you know, arching up and then down again to the height that it began hovering at, and then did that three times, and then paused momentarily, and then accelerated straight up and out of sight, disappearing from view in just a few seconds. Now, that by itself is a pretty remarkable feat,
right?
Any way you cut it. But you have to remember that if you have a propulsion system that is drawing the so-called zero-point energy out of the local environment, so the mass of your vehicle is being decreased dramatically, it means that causing it to accelerate suddenly doesn't become all that much of a chore. Now, you know, I can just hear the pilots out there saying, well, what about all the G-forces? Why isn't the pilot just squashed against the inside of the vehicle? Well, you have to remember that inertia comes from having mass. If you don't have any mass, there's no inertia. In a sense, the inertia is dampened, just like they say on the TV shows. I mean, there really is some legitimacy to the claim of being able to dampen inertia, but you do it by blocking or interrupting the interaction with zero-point energy, principally by using it as the main source of your propulsive energy.
Well, this is that propulsion system alone is pretty remarkable.
It is.
The fact that they worked on it and it's still been hidden boggles my mind, Mark, because you'd think they'd be using this kind of technology all over the place.
Well, I mean, I've already envisioned applying this particular technology to automotive use, to power generation. In fact, I think this is probably the main reason, if not one of the main reasons, that we haven't seen the technology declassified. I mean, from a tactical and strategic standpoint, if you've got a vehicle that can literally be all the way around on the other side of the planet in probably under 10 minutes, which is, you know, three times faster than the best size CBM, and use it as a platform for deploying a weapon, whether it's a tactical weapon or a strategic weapon, you have a tremendous advantage over any enemy. But as a source of power generation, you have to understand that just bringing this right out and putting it into a non-classified status might severely disrupt the world economy, because everything we know of is based on fossil fuels. But the positive aspect of this, in my view, is that even as the jet engine eventually replaced the propeller-driven aircraft, it took decades before, you know, everything was propelled by jet engines, or at least the majority of aircraft were flown around with that particular type of propulsion. And I think the same would be true for bringing this kind of technology out and using it for a way of, sort of reducing our use of fossil fuels, improving or lessening the impact of fossil fuels on the environment, and giving us an alternative source to nuclear energy, which of course has some long-term drawbacks.
Absolutely.
Because of radioactivity and the waste.
Let's chat for a moment as we go up to the top of the hour in about 15 minutes about the alien abduction phenomenon, because mm-hmm. you have also looked at this. I mean, you are
pretty
varied in your career. Tell me what you have found so far, Mark.
Well, it occurred to me, because I've always been kind of a car nut and a nuts and bolts kind of guy. I've always been fascinated by how things work. You know, I heard about these. There was a fellow by the name of Billy Goodman. He used to have a show, sort of the predecessor show in this genre, out of Las Vegas, that talked about, you know, flying saucers and abductions and this kind of thing. And it occurred to me that if any of these people really were being abducted by aliens, and there was a very, very slight chance, you know, maybe just a very slight chance, that they might have seen some kind of propulsion technology if these events were real, if they were really happening. Now, I went into this whole thing very, very skeptical at the outset, and I called up the Billy Goodman Show, and I said, you know, I heard, you know, a couple of these abductees that you had on your program the other night, and I'm an artist, I'm interested in, you know, advanced technologies, and I'd be interested in talking to any of, you know, these young ladies that had these experiences and find out whether or not this is really true. And maybe they saw something that might be, you know, a piece of the puzzle, if you will. Well, it turns out I was right. Of the half dozen or so people that I interviewed, at least two had seen propulsion system components. Now, the interesting thing here is that I wasn't motivated to make any of these kinds of inquiries until I had been told about this so-called mm-hmm. alien reproduction vehicle. I mean, that for me at least suggested that this might be a reality. So I thought, well, okay, well, let's look over in this other area and see sure. what we can find out.
That would do it for me.
Well, but the odd thing about it, George, was that several of these abductee claimants were describing propulsion system components that blow for blow were almost identical in shape, size, relative size, and configuration as what you see right there in the ARV. And these were in other types of vehicles. I mean, you know, not everything in the way of UFOs, you know, are flying saucers. Some of them are sphere-shaped. Some of them are like cylinders or the so-called cigar-shaped UFOs. And in every case, the components that they were describing usually involved a large central column with some kind of a device that was spinning around it. In some cases, the column was even spinning in the opposite direction.
Spinning's very important in
yes.
all this.
Well, in this case, counter-rotation seems to be one of the keys. But the thing that I found interesting, too, was that if you go back through the UFO literature and you look at some of the accounts, especially some of the things that were recorded by Jim and Coral Lawrenson back in the 1950s and 1960s, you find that there are certain specific materials that come up and recur over and over again in the allegations of crashed UFOs, material that is dropped from UFOs that appear to be in trouble or shooting off sparks. And there are two things that we see often, magnesium and mercury. Now, as it happens, one of the witnesses that described this propulsion system said that mercury was one of the key components that was used inside this central column that is actually inside the secondary windings of a very, very large Tesla coil. Now, for some of the audience who don't know what a Tesla coil is, if you've seen any of the old Frankenstein movies where they have these lightning bolts shooting around Frankenstein's laboratory,
right.
those are sort of a kind of Tesla coil. And what it really is it's just a way of taking a certain voltage of electricity and you create a kind of an open air transformer that steps up the voltage but drops down the amperage. And so you can get lightning bolts that look very dramatic, but in some cases, you know, won't even really harm you. You know, the components that some of these abductees were describing were so similar that, you know, I begin to think that this was, you know, really a legitimate claim. But the thing that convinced me more than anything else with regard to the so-called abductees was the fact that they actually had artifacts, if you will, that were not only visible on CAT scans and MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging type of scans, but in one case there was a young lady who had devices that had actually been implanted behind her eardrum that more or less seemed to be replacing the little tiny bones that go between your eardrum and the inner ear. The so-called tympanic bones were replaced in at least two cases on this one individual over the course of about 4 years. What was interesting in that case was that the young lady actually also claimed to be or have been abducted by the military, undergoing a rather grueling examination of you know, just about every part of her body, and in the process went through a really brutal interrogation that left bruises and abrasions down the back of her throat, and they actually wound up damaging one of these auditory implants. Within the following 6 months, the so-called aliens came back, abducted her again, not only replaced the damaged unit in her ear, but put in a second one in the other side. And the reason I know this is because she had gone out and purchased, before any of this had happened, she had gone out and purchased a professional quality otoscope, this little, you know, flashlight thing with a little cone on it that the ear, nose, and throat doctor would kind of use to look in your ear and check out, you know, the health of your eardrum and that kind of thing. What most people don't realize is that the eardrum is so thin, it's like a cellophane membrane, it's translucent, you can see through it. And if it's wet, it's almost like a piece of glass. And so, you know, I looked in this young lady's ear, and I could clearly see, in the latter instance, what appeared to be something like a small metallic, sort of a hockey puck-shaped disc sitting on its edge behind her eardrum, and clearly appeared to be completely replacing the tympanic bones. And in fact, one of the things that she recounted from her military abduction was that overhearing a conversation between a couple of officers in this underground facility where she was taken in the high desert of Southern California, that if they remove this thing, it would certainly permanently impair her hearing. She would probably be deaf from that point on, but it may well kill her as well. And so they opted not to do that. But apparently the aliens were able to replace it after it was damaged. And when I looked in her ear to see exactly what the methodology was that they had used, you could see three spiral cuts that ran down the ear canal leading right up to the eardrum, where they had obviously sort of literally screwed some kind of a mandrel into, or guide, if you will, into the ear canal to very carefully channel whatever surgical instruments were used to go in and replace this device. Now,
amazing.
Absolutely amazing. Stunning, stunning, absolutely stunning. But one of the other individuals that I spoke to had claimed that in the early 1970s that she had been, as a young girl, had been on the way to a ballet lesson with her mom, had had a missing time experience, and then began to have sort of a recollection of what had happened. And she described the approach of a kind of Saturn-shaped UFO that came out of the west right at sunset, managed to stall all of the cars at an intersection where they were sitting in a light, and then a beam of incredible white light came out of this disc and rendered the entire right half of her parents, her mother's car, transparent. And she said that there were these three little individuals that looked like sort of a puffy little Casper the Friendly Ghost type of beings with big black eyes that came walking over and said, "There's been an accident. We need to take you to the hospital." And they pulled her right out through the metal of the car like it was water. And so, you know, I asked her, "Well, you know, how do you know that this really happened?" She says, "Well, I have these implants that show up on the MRIs." And I said, "Well, now how were these put in?" She said, "Well, I woke up inside the craft laying on a kind of soft, what looked like a metal table, but it was pliable, just like a rubber cushion."
So for a guy like you who's been involved in real hard science for a number of years, mm-hmm. all this is not new to you. To me, you sound like you're a believer now.
Well, I wasn't in the beginning, buddy. I'm now. And you know, for me, George, this, you know, I really had to wrestle with this because, you know, I mean, hearing these stories, you know, seeing a couple of these deep scars in the roof of this young lady's mouth where they literally just pressed these two little spheres right through the skin and the roof of her mouth into the lower part of her brain cavity with no anesthetic, I might add.
And she's okay.
Yeah. I mean, but she, of course, she passed out, but these things are there. You can see the skin. In fact, she showed me the scars. I could look in there with the flashlight and see them in the roof of her mouth, and it was very clear what they were, you know. You know, all of this still didn't quite seem like reality to me until finally on the 13th of December, 1989, I was coming back from a date with my girlfriend. We were sitting at a light right just immediately north of the Ontario International Airport in Ontario, California, just on the overpass that goes right over the top of Interstate 10, running through the community of Rancho Cucamonga. And we're sitting there. It's a 10:45. We're looking at Angeles. I think it's Los Angeles Mountain Range north of there, where Mount Baldy and some other places are. Full moon out. You know, it's December. There's snow on the mountains. Clear night. You can see the stars. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes this brilliant bluish white orb from the southeast, going like a son of a gun. And it comes from the southeast. I caught it out of the corner of my eye through the windows of the car, and it drops down in front of the mountains, makes a right angle turn, never slows down.
Not a meteorite, is it?
No. Definitely not a meteorite. Makes a right angle turn to the left, goes about a mile, makes another right angle turn, and goes up through Chaco Canyon, which goes, if you follow the valley, it goes right up to the high desert where Edwards Air Force Base is. In fact, if you follow the trajectory, if you plot it on a map, it's going right to Edwards Air Force, Edwards Air Force Base.
Are you convinced it was extraterrestrial?
Well, in that particular instance, because of the direction it was traveling, not entirely. But I have to tell you that I plotted the time to distance. It was doing at least 5,000 miles an hour,
well,
and there was no sonic boom.
I don't think we have that kind of technology. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie, your phone calls as well with Mark McKendlish. Mark, tell me, of all the stuff you've looked at over the years, is there any one area that fascinates you the most?
Well, you mentioned time travel earlier. And I've been fascinated by time travel ever since, I think it was the 1959 or 1960 film, the Time Machine. I think it was Rod Taylor, based on the H.G. Wells novel.
Yes, Rod Taylor.
Looked kind of like a sled with a spinning disc on the back of it. It was a little funky design there. But, I've always kind of been fascinated with that. Of course, there's the whole Billy Myers Pleiadian thing, time travel from, a star system in the Pleiades system from the future and this kind of thing. I don't know how much credibility I give that particular case, but, I have spoken to people. In fact, Dr. Fred Bell is a friend of mine. Haven't spoken to him in a while, mm-hmm. but, he gives a very dramatic account of a device that he built at great expense to himself, I might add, down in Laguna Beach where he used to live. That involved a number of components remarkably similar to the ARV, or the Alien Reproduction Vehicle. If, in fact, you pick up a copy of his book, I think it's called The Secret Promise, there is a diagram in there, and it's kind of a multifaceted, sort of a polyhedron type of a shaped device, but it also uses a number of these plate capacitors. It uses a variety of switching mechanisms that send high voltage charges around the exterior of the device that he built. And in fact, as I recall, the city of Laguna Beach asked him to remove it because it didn't comply with zoning regulations. But he indicated that while this thing was in operation, that he was actually seeing what appeared to be a moment in time being frozen when he looked out the window of this device that he built. That you could see cars passing at night and that their headlights were slowly pulsing on and then coming back on again as they moved. But they suddenly began moving very slowly as they went by, and then when he turned it off, they resumed to their normal highway speeds, which I thought was, a pretty interesting observation. I mean, at the very least, something's going on there, at least in how it's affecting his perception of time, or in fact, what's going on within the environment inside the vehicle that he built.
All right, let's go to the calls. You ready? We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line first. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Where are you calling from?
Los Angeles.
All
My
right.
name is Bob.
Hello, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Mark.
Hi,
you know, you and I have met each other many, many moons ago. My brother was your brother's best friend back east.
Oh.
My name is Bob. My brothers were Mark and David.
Oh, okay.
Do you remember?
Yes.
I wanted
on Hillside
you.
On Hillside Drive in East Longmeadow.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you remember the time that we went out to the Plains of Fame Museum?
Yes.
With my brother David, he was out working mm-hmm. on a nuke plant
yes.
in town someplace.
Nice to hear from you after all these
a
years.
A nuke plant?
Yeah. He's one of those big brain guys. Anyway, we went through that museum, and of course you were. Encyclopedically knowledgeable about every kind of airplane, and any question I had about anything, you answered completely.
Thank you.
We got all the way out into the back where they have the ratty, junky planes that they haven't fixed up yet.
Mm-hmm, I remember that.
And we got into a big conversation about Timothy Good and Bob Lazar and these women who you met, who you were just talking about, and all the rest of that.
Yeah.
And you just absolutely 100% got me completely fixated on the whole topic. And
well, have you continued researching it on your own?
Absolutely. I think if you recall, I had just moved out to L.A. to get into doing special effects in movies.
Oh, how fascinating.
And I actually, get to do UFOs all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's awesome. So I was really just calling to say hi, and I actually tried emailing you once a long time ago, and I don't think you ever got my email. But
well, you know, we'll have to get back in touch.
Awesome.
All right.
That's great. I'd like
Thanks,
that.
Bob. Well, see, you touch lives too, Mark. Don't even know it sometimes.
Well, you know, I've got a couple little kittens here on my lap that I rescued from the local Wendy's hamburger drive-thru. Somebody dumped them there about a month ago, and I was thinking how nice it'd be to maybe put one of them on the phone and have them purr around the world, you know.
You can do that. Good for you.
But
now, actually, somebody dumped two kittens out there in the parking lot of a fast food place?
Yeah, well, they were remarkably well-fed because all the customers felt sorry for them. That was the surprising
thing.
Where
were they, just hanging around outside?
Well, the landscaping around the drive-thru there is a bunch of juniper bushes, and so there were actually three kittens, two sort of tabby, sort of gray, tiger-striped, leopard pattern kind of kitties. I caught those two kitties the very first night. Within an hour of one another, with a sort of a humane trap that, you know, closes once they touch the food, that kind of thing. But the third kitty was a pure white little kitten, and I spent a month trying to catch this little kitten. And he was so smart. I mean, he actually got into the cage, got some of the food, and got back out again before the door closed. I don't know how he did it, but you know. But then he learned that the trap was a hazard, and he wouldn't go back. So it's been sort of a frustrating experience.
All right, you can let them purr if you want to.
Well, actually, they've run off now.
All right, well, if they come back. East of the Rockies, welcome to the show. Hi there.
How you doing, gentlemen?
Good, sir.
This is Brad. I'm calling from Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, Dayton. That's where the UFOs are up there, aren't they?
That's kind of got something to do with what I'm calling about tonight.
Okay.
First off, just wanted to say you guys sure make a graveyard shift fly.
Well, I'm glad.
Amazing job from both you gentlemen. You always deliver, George. Second off, as far as the animals concerned, I actually had somebody drop a beagle off at my job and saved it, a beautiful beagle dog.
Wow.
And I made sure to save that because that's just cruel to me. Okay, straight to two real quick questions. I'll take both answers off the air.
Okay.
Okay, first quick question. Since I am in Wright Field, and of course, I think everybody, especially all the Coast listeners, are aware of the legend, you know, of this place.
Hangar 18.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, from what I've heard, that's a decoy, but that's another story altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was wondering is I get to see a lot of the aircraft from the base. It flies right over my apartment daily, several times a day. What I was just wondering is your take on possible alien technology that since, you know, the UFO from Roswell and all that was supposed to have been transported here.
Uh-huh.
What is your take on how technology has developed through that, just in Wright Field or maybe all over the world? Second of all, I happened to catch an interview with Willie Nelson, of all people, talking about his tour bus being run on vegetable oil.
Yeah, he's got a new company that is producing this stuff.
And a Mercedes ran on soybean oil.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Now, I was just wondering your take on that and how that could help us, because I believe if farmers benefit and America benefits, why not? So thanks for the show, guys, and I'll take your answers off the air.
Okay, well, back to the fuel portion. You know, there's also, in Carthage, Missouri, there's a plant there that makes fuel out of turkey parts.
No big surprise there. I suppose if you let anything decompose long enough, you're going to get some methane, and that's flammable. But to answer the last question first, he was talking about vegetable oil. The one nice byproduct of that, if you like fast food and you like French fries, is that a lot of that cooking oil, when it goes through the exhaust system, tends to make your car smell like a fast food restaurant and French fries that have just come out of the fryer. But the second question, how do I think, if the stories surrounding the crash at Roswell, the crash at Aztec, the crash at Corona, the crash at Paradise, Arizona, there are a number of crashes. And in fact, there are some people that have estimated there may have been as many as 30 different crashes around the world, many of which were recovered by the U.S. military. You know, how that affected Wright-Patterson directly, I really can't say. I mean, of course, there's the story about Barry Goldwater and some of the questions he had regarding the recovered alien bodies and that sort of thing. I don't really know how much there is to the legend, but based on the technology that I've personally seen flying around and doing things that just seemed absolutely impossible, and the multitude of people that I've spoken with that have either seen it in hangars or have worked on it. I've actually talked to people that have worked on this thing, too. I have to tell you that it's obvious that if they didn't, you know, completely back-engineer the technology, at least they got some good ideas, at the very least.
Well, you're right about that. I wish we could. I wish somebody else would really come forward. There have been a few people, of course, the Bob Lazars. But, God, I don't know. I just wish more people would come forward. Stephen Greer tried to get some people to come forward. And
well, you know, and there's a lot of witnesses on his list that haven't gone public and haven't been recorded because they're waiting for Congress to, you know, have public hearings where, you know, they will be given immunity.
Immunity
because,
from prosecution, sure.
Yeah, in fact, surprisingly, George, I mean, when you engage people, and I just seem to have the gift of gab when it comes to talking about things like this. You know, anybody who's interested in aircraft, if you can get them talking, you say, well, you know, have you ever seen a UFO? You would be surprised, George, really, how many people say they've seen something really interesting. And this, I was at a local internet service provider one day, and I heard a couple of guys talking about magnetic fields and this, that, and the other thing, and I got to talking to this one guy. And it turned out he had actually been a special ops soldier in 1989 who participated in the recovery of one of our anti-gravity vehicles that had crashed in East Germany right before the Iron Curtain fell. In fact, the crash occurred on 4 May 1989 in the wee hours of the morning. He was part of a unit that was already in East Germany extracting what he called assets. That would be people who they suspected that the secret police would kill if they thought that they were double agents for the U.S. Government and that kind of thing. But they were already inside East Germany, you know, flying, you know, under the radar, as it were, and were diverted to this crash site. And this was a vehicle that had been conducting surveillance somewhere down in the vicinity of the Czech Republic. It had been passing through the sort of southwestern corner of East Germany. And the guy was flying a NOTE mission, that's Nap of the Earth, or, you know, just following the contours of the Earth to stay below the radar, and coming up over a rise, clipped a pine tree and damaged the vehicle enough that it crashed. So he describes coming in by helicopter and participating in this recovery. And this particular vehicle was a flying triangle. It had three white spheres in its, you know, unbroken condition, that is. It had a white sphere under each corner. It flew base forward, that is to say, it would be like an arrowhead flying backwards with the broad edge in the lead and the point, you know, in trail. And they had a cockpit that looked remarkably similar to the angular cockpit and windows of the stealth fighter. That it had a two-seat cockpit tandem, one behind the other, just like an F-16 trainer. In fact, he said the heads-up display, the controls for the flight of the vehicle looked almost identical to those in an F-16. And he said that one of the three spheres that had been under the very tail end of the vehicle had broken free, had been undamaged in the impact, but the fuselage had cracked open, and this thing had popped out and was floating around the hillside next to the vehicle. And he and some other people were sent to recover this thing. And he said it looked like a white pumpkin, except that each of the striations in the pumpkin had little ridges on it, like you would see on a scallop shell, like for the Shell Oil Company logo.
A clamshell.
Yeah, exactly. Just little curved lateral ridges, almost like you know the Spanish tiles on those roofs you see in Southern California and stuff. But each one of the ribs in this so-called the somewhat pumpkin-shaped design of this sphere had these little ridges, and it was floating several inches off the ground. He said they were asked to sort of capture this thing, so they took a one of these utility crates, sort of an all-aluminum stamped. A footlocker, you know, with a hinge that can pop loose by moving it sideways, opened it up and tried to put it over the top of this thing or slide it up underneath it, and it kept repelling the aluminum that this case was made out of, and they then slid the lid under this thing and brought the larger portion of the case down over the top of it, engaged the hinges, you know, closed the clasps on it, and as soon as they let go of it, the thing stood up like a gravestone all by itself and sort of vibrated in position, you know, like somebody snapping to a really sharp attention.
Yeah.
It scared the daylights out of these poor guys, you know, really kind of spooky. But they wound up flying in a CH-53 Super Stallion helicopter with a very, very long lanyard that they hooked this case up to so that it wouldn't affect the electronics of the helicopter, and they flew it over into West Germany immediately. The pilots were already gone. They had some technicians there that were taking classified components out of the system. They had sort of a group of people gathering up parts that had broken off of this thing, and after they'd gotten all the loose parts away from the vehicle and took them, put them into some Mercedes-Benz trucks waiting on a nearby road that they had appropriated from the local economy, they then put a couple of thermite grenades into what was left of the fuselage and basically burned it up right there on the spot. It was about 45 kilometers northeast of the city of Halle, East Germany.
Why did they do that?
Well, because apparently, you know, being behind what at that time was enemy lines,
they
didn't want to leave
anything
behind.
So they didn't want
behind.
It captured.
Said that the vehicle, the chassis, the fuselage was largely a composite material, so, of course, it would probably burn very well.
Yeah, that's something. Okay, back to the calls. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Steve calling from Clearwater. I have a couple of questions about that acetone you mentioned.
Sure, Steve, go ahead.
I was wondering, where can you get this at, and could I use it in a Geo Metro?
You can get it at a good pharmacy store. You can get it at an auto parts store.
How about AutoZone?
AutoZone can have it, yes.
You can get it, sure.
Yeah, and could I use it in unleaded gas or not?
Yes.
Well, it's got to be premium. Premium.
Yeah, you should use, it's recommended that you use premium gasoline.
Now, is this stuff the same as some of these additives that you can buy? Because I have something here.
Some additives do have acetone in it.
Because I have something called RXP, and it says fuel exhaust system cleaner and combustion, and it says it decarbonizes the exhaust. Is that the same type of thing you're talking
about? It certainly sounds like it. I mean,
I saw
exactly those kinds of results. I mean, you know, if you see the inside of an exhaust system that's pure white, I mean, it was remarkable.
And what do I look for? Is it, you say, an 8?
Well, it's spelled A-C-E-T-O-N-E, and like I say, you can get a quart can, not a plastic bottle, but a steel can.
What section would it be in the auto parts?
Fiberglass repair.
Okay, so it's in that section.
Yeah. Acetone is used for thinning polyester resin.
All right, not in the additives then.
Was this the same stuff that's in like for thinning paint and stuff?
Or yeah, that's acetone. Same thing. Well, it's also a finger polish remover.
Yeah, I've seen that in nail polish.
Yeah, that's it. Same thing. Same thing. Okay, good. Go for it. Good luck to you. And again, give us the proportions, Mark.
2.5 ounces of acetone to every 10 gallons of premium gasoline, or 1.5 ounces to every 10 gallons of diesel.
Okay, and
this works in semi-trucks. It works in little tiny cars with 3-cylinder piston engines.
If there is ethanol in your premium already, it's not going to hurt that, is it?
No, I don't think it would. It just doesn't work as effectively.
Okay, so instead of getting a 20 or 25% bump in your fuel,
you might only see 5 or 10%.
Okay, but does it pay for itself?
Well, in my case, it sure has.
Well, that's the important thing.
I mean, you know, if you're getting 26, I mean, the factory sticker, I still have a factory sticker for my car when I bought it new. It got 26 miles per gallon highway.
I hope you took the sticker down.
Well, of course, you know, I kind of a pack rat, I saved it. But I've gotten as high as 34, 35 miles per gallon.
That's not bad.
On the highway, yeah.
How about these new cars, these little mini things that get 40?
You know, yeah, lightweight vehicles with small engines. You know, it's a recipe for high mileage.
It's still not an incentive to keep, these kinds of fuels, gasoline and oil. I think we still need to go to like a hydrogen fuel or something like that.
Well, I think it'd be good. Although I read an article, and I think it was either Popular Science or Popular Mechanics recently, that indicated that the energy it takes to produce hydrogen by itself is actually more expensive in terms of its impact on the environment than you actually gain by using the hydrogen in the car.
Okay, and some of these home remodeling stores, these big ones, in the furniture refinishing area right around there, you can pick it up real cheap. I'll be back in a moment. You know, Mark, these big oil companies have people assigned to listen to Coast to Coast.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah. And then when it comes to programs like this, they must be pulling out their hair.
Well, I mean, you know, but if you got somebody saying, but it only works with premium gasoline, the very most expensive gasoline they can sell, maybe they'll like it. You never know.
Are you on their payroll then?
No. Actually, if I was, my circumstances at this end would be a lot different.
But actually, anything that improves gasoline mileage, they don't like. I'm convinced of that.
Well, I mean, I've actually talked to one of these people that invented a carburetor and got a patent on it that was capable of almost 150 miles per gallon. His name's Alan Caggiano from Brockton, Massachusetts. And his story is probably one of the most horrifying chain events I have ever heard.
Is he still alive?
Well, I think within the last year or so, I believe he suffered a stroke.
And interesting. So
yeah. I'm not sure if he is still alive, but... His story is so incredible that somebody really ought to make a movie about it, because he actually had like a 1973 Cutlass Ohls 442 that was getting 76 miles to a gallon of gas.
God.
And the thing was, he was an air conditioning repairman, and there was a special solvent that he would use when he was cleaning out the heat exchangers, a radiator like device in these air conditioning systems. It was a solvent that he would use to clean out the oil that, sort of lubricates the compressor in these systems. And he forgot that on one occasion. So he went down to his truck and he got a can of gasoline, poured it into this heat exchanger, shook it, and then went to pour the gasoline out, and the only thing that came out was vapor. And he said, aha. And that was the basis for his design.
Interesting.
And the next thing you know, he's got people showing up offering him $20,000 to forget about it. And he didn't want to do it.
$20 million, he might forget about it.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that the offer has probably escalated, but it got to the point where the local Brockton police were participating in searches and, trying to plant drugs in his house.
I
mean,
God.
It really got horrible. But the most scary thing of the whole story was that when everything else failed, when the police and all of these sort of back-channel things that were going on to try and put this guy away failed, a guy from the Department of Justice shows up and submits a friend of the court brief to the judge and says, this gentleman was a person who pleaded nolo contender to a misdemeanor.
It means no challenge.
Yes, in Massachusetts for, I think it was a public disorder or some kind of minor thing. But in the state of Massachusetts, you can get over a year for that particular penalty as a misdemeanor. And this particular law, and this law is cited on his website, this particular law can be, at the government's whim, can be brought into effect, can be invoked, and any conviction that involves a misdemeanor in one of the states that can carry a penalty of a year or more can be converted retroactively to a felony,
and you could
be put away. So then they took his two shotguns that he had, and they said, well, you're a felon in possession of two firearms, you're a recidivist, you're a career criminal, away for 40 years. And that's where they sent him.
He's in the pogey?
He went to a prison in Plymouth, Massachusetts, that I have not been able to find on any of
And now he's had a stroke.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about it was that this was a prison where the government sends all the people who know stuff they're not supposed to know. And he was diagnosed after about 6 years in prison with terminal cancer. And he was escorted to and from the main prison by a guy who was a doctor who found a cure for soft tissue cancers, just like what this guy had. And he told him about it. He was given a discharge from the prison about a month later because they thought he was going to die. And he immediately began using this regimen that the guy gave him, was basically just eating almonds, onions, and garlic, in a fixed quantity each day. And within 6 months, his incurable cancer was gone. His oncologist was mortified. And the funny thing about it, George, is I've actually proven this myself, because I had a dog, Casey, 94-pound mixed breed dog that got an incurable form of cancer called a hemangiosarcoma about 2 years ago. He was given about 2 weeks to live when he was diagnosed by a well-known canine oncologist in Sacramento. 2 months tops is what he said. And I told him about this regimen and what I thought its mechanism was, how it would work, and how it might actually cause the tumor to begin to recede and sort of absorb itself. And he thought it was very interesting, and he actually acknowledged some of the facts that I shared with him that seemed to support what I was saying. So he said, well, go ahead and try it and tell me about it. And 2 months later, Casey was still alive and kicking. And, in fact, he lasted for almost a year, for about 10 and a half months, before his arthritis became so bad he simply couldn't stand up anymore.
You know the story of Dr. Eugene Malov, of course.
Yeah,
same thing. Here's a guy who's working on zero-point energy and alternative energy, and, you know, he's murdered. Let's go to the phones. He's to the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, my name's John.
Hi, John.
I've called in a couple times before. I'm former military intelligence. You've got some very interesting ideas. Remember back in the 80s, mid-80s and 90s, they had the F-117 sightings over the East Coast?
Mm-hmm.
There were the black flying triangles?
Yes.
Well, now you've got these ones that Art Bell's seen and some of the other listeners, and it's almost identical to what you've described.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not surprising. In fact, I was the fellow that did the artwork that appeared on Art Bell's site of the vehicle that he saw.
Right. When I was in the military, I had a chance to access some files that I, well, shouldn't have. George would know that his days in the Navy, the Navy would absolutely love to have something like the F-117 based aboard a carrier.
Sure.
So these aircraft that I've seen, and pretty much what you've described are identical, are actually naval aircraft. Designed as tactical fighters.
Is that right?
Knock out the radar, come back out. Because they're short-range takeoff, they're perfect for carriers.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I mean, if you think about a triangle as kind of a stubby flying wing design, the efficiency, the lift efficiency, lift-to-weight ratio is something like, oh, gosh, what is it? 200% or something. I don't remember exactly what the figure is because I'm not an aerodynamicist.
Except they're not nearly as big as we're talking about, Mark. Okay.
Well, I mean, the giant things that we've discussed earlier, I don't think that's what he's referring to when he says a tactical or an attack-type carrier-based aircraft, because that would have to be somewhat smaller, probably no more than 70 foot in length, maybe no more than 60 feet wide, and probably need some kind of folding wing design in order to be able to be stored
away
in a carrier,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Steve, and I'm calling from about 25 miles east of you, George, in Claremont, California.
Yes, you are. Hi, Steve.
Hi, George. Thank you so much. My wife, Lynn, and I have listened to you since you've started with the Coast and, of course, with Art well before that.
Well, thank you.
You often talk about there being no such thing as a coincidence, and I was kind of half listening to the show and half reading Craig B. Hewlett's book. And I heard your guest talking about an area that I was spent a couple of hours in today by the 10 in the Ontario airport. And then ironically, he also mentioned, and this gets really good, he mentioned going up this, he saw this craft travel up the coast, or up the Cajon Pass. And towards Edwards Air Force Base. I actually also went in that direction today to drop my son off where he lives with his mom up in the high desert. On top of that, so when I heard those areas being mentioned, I really started listening. And what it really reminded me of is my wife and I have a place up in right above the Southern California. And what your guest referred it to as the Los Angeles Mountains, they're actually the San Gabriel Mountains.
Okay, there we go.
And right. And we have a little place up in Wrightwood. And it overlooks the entire high desert as well as Palmdale, Lancaster, but also Edwards Air Force Base.
Yeah, that's a great vantage point. I've actually spent several nights up there, and you will see things if you go there often
enough.
You
bet. Well, you know what the big thing is, Mr. McCandish? I've never seen anything myself. But I've been up there for 5 years. I've had a place up there, so I have a lot of friends in the area. It's a small town.
Well, let me make a suggestion for you then. You got to remember that the guys that fly these things are probably working a 5-day work week.
Sure.
And they probably fly these things between Monday and Friday, and they usually fly them between 10:30 at night and about 4 a.m. So
right.
That's when you got to go look.
Understood, but I wanted to make a point. The point is, while I have never seen them, a number of my neighbors in that town have.
Oh.
It's one of the big speaks up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during the winter, it's a ski resort town.
That's right. I've been there.
And during the summer, you know, it's a beautiful place. But
that's right.
There's about 4,000 local residents. And it's a great place to live because you've got Southern California here, 35 minutes up the Cajon, you're in your 7,000-foot mountain cabin. So it's a really incredible place to be. But So I've never seen anything like I said, but boy, you want to get information. You go back to that little town and spend a weekend talking to some of the locals.
Oh, yeah.
And people have got stories. I won't give you any of them because that'd be like third-party stories.
Sure.
And this thing is fragile enough as it is with UFOs and that sort of thing. Okay. I have one question, though.
Okay.
Okay. When we're in that cabin, last summer, it was probably about a year ago, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and we got up there on weekends occasionally, and we were out on the deck, and it's beautiful, pitch black. Oh. You could see a little bit of high desert.
So did you see something?
Light. Well, what happened was my wife is sitting out on the deck, and the entire sky flashed brilliant white just for 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
And we have never, we've not talked to anybody who has also seen it.
Well, I actually know someone who's seen that exact same thing.
You're kidding.
And actually saw the point source where it occurred going through the El Cajon Pass on his way to a teaching job in Victorville, and he said that it looked like a sudden growing bright transparent sphere that rapidly expanded to a size that appeared to be perhaps 1,000 feet in diameter and then vanished.
That's something. All right, thanks for that call. So many calls, not enough time. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. Joe from Boston.
Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Good to have
hey,
you
Mark.
With us.
Hey, man. Marshall, how you doing?
Great town, Boston.
Yeah, I know, but I'd like to move to a warmer climate. I've got a couple of things I want to talk to you about. First is the aliens.
Okay.
Is there any way that people could contact them or how they, with all this technology, you would think they would use it in the medical establishment? Like you were just talking about that website. I don't know what website it is. Maybe you'll give it out. And about this guy up here from Brockton, what's his name, Alan something or other?
Calgiano.
Yeah, Calgiano?
It's C-A-G-G-I-A-N-N-O, I believe.
Yeah, and contact the aliens or people could communicate with them and somehow help people get better. And can you tell us more about this?
Well, I don't know that Alan Calgiano has anything to do with aliens. But
no, but I'm just using that as an example. But how can people, is there any way that they could get involved with people? Because I heard Dr. Boyland on the other night, and I sent him a little note, and he says the Star Kids don't intervene or get involved, and it's sad.
Well, you know, I have spoken to people, in fact, a number of these so-called abductees who have been diagnosed with cancer and a number of other serious terminal illnesses and have been miraculously cured. I know that sounds tremendously far-fetched, but, you know, it's fairly well documented from what I understand.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your phone call. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. It's you.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody there, George.
Is that just you talking to
yes,
me?
Yes, it is.
It is you. I thought perhaps the caller sounded like you.
Hey, George, while we have just a second, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind if I give a plug to the fellow who has pulled me out of the fire and actually built my website from nothing. His name is Larry.
In a week, by the way.
Oh, no, actually, I had no computer as of Friday. I got a computer Friday. He started working on this thing late, I think it was Sunday, early Monday, and the thing is up and running now. I mean, the man is an absolute genius. He has a site where he actually builds websites for corporations and private individuals at sentientlight.com.
Oh, you better spell that.
It's S-E-N-T-I-E-N-T-L-I-G-H-T. It's all one word, no spaces, all lowercase, .com. sentientlight.com.
Yeoman's work there, huh?
Yes, I mean, he's just an absolute genius.
Okay, let's go to another call. Wildcard line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
Hello.
Yeah.
Good evening. Yeah, this is Evan. I'm calling from Houston.
Hi Evan, and I'm glad all is well for you.
Great. Yeah, it's a great show, great guest. You were talking about zero-point energy earlier a little
yes.
bit, and a couple of things occurred to me, just some thoughts. It seems our friend Mr. Einstein left us with a lot of food for thought on many different subjects. But
well put.
Yeah. Regarding a little paper that he published in 1905 that won him a Nobel Prize, basically demonstrating the particle nature of light, photons in effect,
mm-hmm.
You said that if mass travels fast at the speed of light, it basically increases in mass. right?
Well, actually, if you take an object having mass and you accelerate it through space-time, its
right.
mass increases. Now, Einstein's proposition was that if you continue to accelerate, the mass becomes greater and greater until it is so great, it literally becomes infinite, and it makes
right.
it impossible for anything to propel the vehicle forward. I mean, you just couldn't
okay.
have enough fuel to do that.
Okay, well, it occurs to me that because of the wave-particle duality that, in effect, he created with that paper, that perhaps photons and other forms of electromagnetic energy are, in fact, really just small points of two-dimensional zero-point energy that are essentially spinning through space and traveling at the speed of light.
Well, you do know that photons have almost no registerable mass.
Right. They have
almost no detectable mass. Well, now,
right.
it's interesting you should say that because another individual I've corresponded with for almost 23 years, Colonel Thomas Bearden, who I believe has been a guest on this program, he's one of the people that sort of inspired Richard Hoagland's discussion on hyperdimensional physics. Now, Tom Bearden has told me that the photon is actually nothing more than an electron that has gone through a process he calls a 90-degree orthorotation out of this dimension, so that it's sort of in between this dimension and another mathematically modeled dimension that's parallel to this one, that in effect it is kind of like a particle that's sort of achieved a place in space and time where it has no ability to absorb zero-point energy and gain mass as a consequence.
I'd love to talk with Tom Bearden. He's a little skittish to go in front of the media, but he's got some incredible theories, Mark.
He does. I mean, he's a genius in his own right, and he's been challenged by a number of the people in the mainstream physics community, but he is also, in fact, you talk about weather engineering and some of these other things that have been described on this program. He predicted a year ago that we would have storms like Katrina and Rita.
Yeah,
and he indicated that it was going to be as a consequence of weather engineering.
Could you talk to him for us?
I'd be happy to.
In the fact that you know us, you know the program,
yes.
I think that would comfort him a little bit better.
Oh, yeah.
Let's do that. And, Mark, we are out of time. Let's make sure that you come back not another 7.5 years from now, okay?
Well, I'd love to, George. And it's been great talking with you. You're a terrific talent in your own right.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's good to talk with you.